content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is underwritten by the law firm of W.G. Alexander & Associates. Alexander attorneys provide top-rated and experienced legal counsel, concentrating on estate planning, elder law, special needs, and asset protection. Call W.G. Alexander & Associates at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the first new issue of 2022 of The Week. It's dated January 21st, 2022. The cover drawing this week shows a man. We can't see his face, but it's presumably Donald Trump. He's got the familiar dark blue suit, red tie. Actually has a cufflink that says 45 on it. He's standing behind an eagle. He's got it one wing in a tight grip, and in his left hand he's got a knife held to the eagle's throat. Kind of a grim scene. The headline is America in Peril. Can democracy survive polarization, the big lie, and the next election? And we'll get a couple of stories on that, starting with the first main story. January 6th anniversary underlines the national divide. What happened? The nation marked the anniversary of the January 6th uprising last week, a milestone Democrats observed with a day of events that highlighted a deep partisan divide over the meaning of the Capitol riot. For Democrats, it was a day of solemn reflection on an insurrection stoked by Donald Trump's false claims of a stolen election, which left five people dead, injured more than 140 police officers, and sent lawmakers scurrying for their lives. Members of Congress gathered on the Capitol steps for a candlelight vigil and gave speeches recounting their shock and terror fleeing from an invading mob that smashed its way into the Senate chamber, chanting, "Hang Mike Pence," and hunting House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. America does not yet know just how close we, the members here in this room today, our nation and our democracy came to our demise that terrifying day, said Representative Ann Custer, Democrat from New Hampshire. President Biden gave a blistering speech focused on Donald Trump and his continued insistence of widespread fraud, calling him a defeated former president who spread a web of lies about the 2020 election. Unable to accept losing, Trump has put a dagger at the throat of our democracy, Biden said. Except for Senator Liz Cheney and her father, former Vice President Dick Cheney, Republicans sat out the events. At a news conference, Representative Matt Gaetz, Republican from Florida, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican from Georgia, called Democrats the true insurrectionist and invoked the false conspiracy theory that FBI agents instigated the riot. Trump canceled a planned press conference, but issued a statement attacking the total bias and dishonesty of the January 6th commission and calling the 2020 election the crime of the century. In a televised speech, Attorney General Merrick Garland vowed to hold all January 6th perpetrators at any level accountable under law. He said that more than 700 participants had been arrested and more than 275 charged with obstruction of Congress, and indicated that prosecutions of those criminally responsible for directing the attack may follow. "The actions we have taken thus far will not be our last," he said. What the editorial said: January 6th isn't in the past, said the New York Times. Trump's twisted version of reality still holds sway over his party and a movement that increasingly is openly contemptuous of democracy. Election officials of both parties are facing death threats. States are making it easier to invalidate election results. And Trump and his acolytes continue to stoke the flames of conflict with his rampant lies and limitless resentments. Our democracy is in grave danger. Democracy isn't dying, said the Wall Street Journal. January 6th was a national disgrace, but the mob and Trump's war room of motley characters never came close to overturning the election. The fact is that America's democratic institutions held up under pressure, thanks in large part to Republican officials who held firm and certified electoral votes and Republican-appointed judges who rejected flimsy election challenges. Not that you'd know that from listening to Democrats who seem intent on exploiting that day to retain power. What the columnist said. Biden's powerful, angry address was the speech of his presidency, and one he never wanted to give, said Susan Glasser in The New Yorker. Elected as a uniter, Biden still had hopes of healing the breach when he took office in the uprising's aftermath. Now he's been forced to acknowledge that Trump and Trumpism live on as the dominating, unpleasant reality of American political life, and that he must stand and fight it. The speech proved only that the unpopular Biden is a drowning man who'll grab onto anything that remotely resembles a life raft, said Michelle Goodwin in the New York Post. The same goes for the rest of his party, who are trying to criminalize political opposition and paint all Trump voters, including the millions who were nowhere near the Capitol during the riot, as enemies of the state. That's a far greater danger to democracy than anything that happened on January 6th. A year after the Capitol assault, what is most striking is not what has changed, but what has not, said Peter Baker in the New York Times. For a brief moment after that shocking event, it looked like Americans in both political tribes would unite in revulsion against an attempt to overturn democracy. Instead, it became heresy for Republicans to disavow Trump's big lie, and most GOP officials now pretend the attempt to overturn the election never happened. What happened on January 6th was horrific, said Mona Shirin in the Bulwark. What's happened since is worse. That day should have been the pivot point at which even the most blinkered sugarcoaters of Trumpism recoiled in disgust. Instead, the GOP has accelerated its transformation into an authoritarian personality cult, purged of anyone not loyal to Trump. Among Republican voters, two-thirds of whom believe the election was stolen, January 6th is not even viewed as regrettable. Trump's improvised coup may have failed, but with such groundwork laid, another attempt, and even a success, is all too possible. We'll go right into the second main story. Omicron sends cases and hospitalizations soaring. What happened? Troubling new COVID records were set as the highly contagious Omicron variant tore across the U.S. this week, with more than 1.4 million new COVID cases being reported in a single day and hospitalization numbers hitting new highs. An average of 760,000 infections are now being detected daily, triple the number of the last peak in January 2021. Former Food and Drug Administration Director Scott Gottlieb estimates that 40% of Americans will have been infected by the time the surge ends. More than 147,000 people are currently in the hospital with COVID, some 5,000 more than last winter's high. And disease modelers predict that total will reach 300,000 within weeks. Some of the hospitalizations come from people being admitted for other reasons and then testing positive, indicating how widespread the infections have become. About 1,700 Americans are dying of COVID daily, roughly half the number at last year's peak, aligning with evidence from Europe and South Africa that while Omicron is far more infectious than previous variants, it tends to produce milder illness. Still, data from New York indicate that Omicron remains dangerous for the unvaccinated, who are 13 times more likely to be hospitalized with the disease than the fully vaccinated. New infections appear to be stabilizing in the New York metro area and in Washington, D.C., suggesting the Omicron surge may be short-lived. But the variant is now expected to hit the Midwest and the Great Plains. It's hard to process what's actually happening, said Acting FDA Commissioner Dr. Janet Woodcock, which is most people are going to get COVID. What the editorial said. A year ago, President Biden vowed to defeat the virus, said the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. His plans didn't survive contact with the enemy. Realizing that the pathogen is no respecter of federal power, Biden and his team are now prepping Americans to accept the virus as part of life, with the American even admitting last week that the virus is probably here to stay. That sounds a lot like what Trumpers used to say at the beginning of this whole thing. Biden can still turn COVID from a dire emergency into just another manageable malady, said the Washington Post. Six public health and medical officials who took part in his presidential transition detailed how to do that last week in the Journal of the American Medical Association. They urged the administration to vastly improve access to low-cost diagnostic testing and create a comprehensive federal infection reporting system, accelerate efforts to develop a universal coronavirus vaccine, one shot that would hit all variants, and to provide no-cost, convenient outpatient treatments for all COVID patients. These are hefty undertakings, but the investment will be well worth it. What the columnist said. Omicron isn't living up to the apocalyptic predictions of some particularly fearful public health experts, said Jim Garrity in National Review. Still, complications, headaches, and inconveniences are piling up. At least 5,225 U.S. schools experienced pandemic-related disruptions over the past week. Some simply didn't have enough healthy teachers to send to classrooms. In New York City, subway lines had to shut down and trash went uncollected because so many workers were out sick. Omicron is more than an inconvenience for hospitals, said Dr. Craig Spencer in the New York Times. In the emergency room where I work, fewer of my patients today need life support than in March 2020, but the sheer number of Omicron patients is overwhelming already exhausted staff and creating another source of infection for doctors and nurses. About 500,000 healthcare workers have quit since February 2020, and 15% of staff at some hospitals are now out with the virus. Hospitals cannot operate with such shortages. To avoid the complete collapse of our healthcare system, we need even vaccinated people to behave responsibly in the coming weeks, including by staying home if they're not feeling well. In places hit by Omicron before us, nearly all the signs have been positive, said David Wallace Wells in New York Magazine. South Africa's surge peaked after 4 weeks, with a fraction of the deaths in the previous wave. In the UK, the current wave also appears to be subsiding rapidly. But the U.S. doesn't have South Africa's young population, nor the UK's high vaccination rate. By the time Omicron ebbs here, we may have suffered considerably more severe illness and death than we've seen on the other side of the Atlantic. Controversy of the week. America's schism. Are we headed for a civil war? Not long ago, the idea of another American civil war seemed outlandish, said Ron Elving in NPR.org. But now it seems to suddenly be everywhere. Last week marked the first anniversary of the January 6th Capitol insurrection, when our proud 225-year streak of peaceful transitions between presidents came to a violent, bloody halt. In the ensuing year, that awful day seems only to have deepened the partisan divide and the belief that further violence may be inevitable. A recent Washington Post poll found that 40% of Republicans and 23% of Democrats, in other words, tens of millions of people, now believe that violent attacks on the government are sometimes justified. Another recent poll found that a majority of Republicans and 41% of Biden voters agreed that it may be time to split the country. Trump Republicans are even more deeply convinced than a year ago that the 2020 election was stolen, said Zach Bocamp in Vox. And far-right Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene has called for a national divorce. But conservatives and progressives see each other as existential threats and believe that election rules have been rigged against them. That makes it more and more likely that neither party will view a victory by the other as legitimate, which political scientists and historians warn often precedes democratic collapse. The divisions in our society are real and deep, said Stephen Hayward in the New York Post, but projections of a new civil war are overwrought. First of all, we lack the sectional geographical divide that you need for a proper war. Despite the lazy pundit shorthand of red and blue states, the real national schism is between the cultures of urban and rural communities. The two sides don't have armies either, said John Harris in Politico. And this notional civil war would be fought about what exactly? In 1860, the issue was slavery. And while we enough mutual distrust to fuel years of rancorous politics, actual civil wars generally need a real cause, some great question that will be resolved by the outcome. That question may be whether white conservative Christians can tolerate a multiracial secular America, said David Remnick in The New Yorker. The election of Barack Obama to the White House in 2008 deepened the fear of many right-wing rural whites that they were losing their majority status. Today, tens of millions of white Americans are increasingly skeptical of free elections and are openly talking about Hungary-style strongman rule as their best defense against being replaced by immigrants and people of color. A second civil war wouldn't involve uniformed armies clashing on grassy battlefields, said Lincoln Mitchell in NBCNews.com. It would take the form of numerous, perhaps hundreds, of rival militias using high-powered explosives and assault weapons to conduct terrorist attacks and political assassinations. The once unthinkable has become thinkable, said David Smith in The Guardian. For a glimpse of where we may be headed, consider the troubles that plagued Northern Ireland in the 20th century. Bombings, guerrilla warfare, kidnappings, and assassinations of judges and elected leaders. Civil war isn't inevitable, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. But even greater conflict than we've seen in recent years seems more likely than a return to the sort of democratic stability many Americans grew up with. January 6 feels more like the beginning than the end. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for feuds. After former President Trump blasted fellow Republicans who don't admit they've had vaccine booster shots, calling them gutless. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, a Trump protege widely seen as a possible rival for the 2024 GOP presidential nomination, recently refused to answer whether he'd been boosted. It was a good week for getting the jab after British doctors treating men who've had COVID reported that the virus sometimes damages blood vessels in the penis, causing impotence and a permanent reduction in its size. And it was a good week for mandates after North Korea launched a campaign to pressure citizens to produce more human and animal poop for fertilizing crops. North Koreans who fail to meet their manure quota will be fined and not allowed into public food markets, the government said. But it was a bad week for military surplus after the Norwegian military announced that due to shortages, soldiers must turn in underwear issued during their mandatory military service so it can be recycled to new conscripts. It's a bad week for mighty steeds after a team of British historians and archaeologists concluded from a study of bones that the medieval war horses ridden by knights into battle were the size of modern-day ponies, with the great majority less than 4'10". There are very few that are the sort of size portrayed in film, said a researcher. Finally, it was a bad week for flourishes after a British surgeon, Simon Bramhall, was banned from practicing medicine for branding his initials on livers he had just transplanted. Bramhall has admitted doing the branding, which he called stupid and entirely wrong. The briefing this week is chaos on the roads. The pandemic has triggered a dramatic surge in speeding, reckless driving, and deadly crashes. Why? What's gone wrong? America's highways, city avenues, residential streets, and rural backroads are more dangerous than ever, as motorists who've been unhinged by the pandemic are driving like maniacs. In 2020, despite millions of workers staying home and traffic plummeting, there were an estimated 38,680 U.S. auto-related deaths, a 7% increase from 2019. As traffic started to normalize this year, roadway deaths jumped 18%, marking the biggest six-month increase since federal government began tracking fatal crashes in 1975. There's been a surge of single-vehicle accidents and daredevil speeding, with California in 2020 issuing nearly 28,500 tickets to drivers topping 100 miles per hour. Tragedies are piling up. Yolanda Bosnier, 59, of Pomona, California, was killed in bed when a drunk driver slammed into her house. A motorist in Yonkers, New York, drove into an oncoming sedan at such high speed that the collision split the second vehicle in half, killing four recent high school graduates. "People are flying down the road," said Maine State Police Corporal Doug Cropper. "It's just ridiculous." Why so many crashes? The most basic reason is that when highways and roads became much emptier because of COVID, it became easier for drivers to accelerate to lethal speeds. The pandemic also reversed decades of progress instilling safe driving habits. Fewer drivers are buckling seatbelts, more are driving while using their phones, and as alcohol sales and drug overdoses have soared during the pandemic, so have DUIs. In one survey, more than 7% of adults admitted they were more likely to drive while impaired since COVID arrived. Among accidents resulting in deaths or serious injuries, the proportion of drivers who test positive for opioids has nearly doubled since 2020, and marijuana use has also increased substantially. But many sober drivers, too, act like they're racing in the Indy 500. Safety be damned. What's causing this behavior? Psychologists say reckless driving is a symptom of widespread feelings of isolation, depression, resentment, and despair. We might decide, what does a seatbelt or another beer matter anyway when we're in the middle of a pandemic, said Shannon Frederoli, a researcher at Johns Hopkins University. Reckless driving can be an outlet for rebellion and boredom after being cooped up and subjected to restrictions you chafe at, said Frank Farley, a Temple University psychology professor. David Spiegel of Stanford University says the rampant disregard for others' safety on the roads is connected to the sharp rise in homicides and the hostility toward mask and vaccination requirements. That fundamental disrespect for social responsibility, Spiegel said, is endangering all of us. Where is it worst? No corner of the country has been spared. U.S. rural areas continue to suffer a disproportionate number of crashes, mostly due to there being fewer medians and turning lanes. But urban areas certainly have felt the plague of restless driving, too. In New York City, which introduced reforms in 2014 aimed at eliminating traffic deaths within a decade, traffic-related deaths shot up in 2020 to at least 243, the highest toll since those programs took effect. What about pedestrians? They account for much of the spike in car-related fatalities. The spike in pedestrian deaths began before the pandemic, with cars killing roughly 6,600 pedestrians in 2019, a more than 50% increase from a decade earlier. That's largely because so many motorists now drive larger, heavier vehicles like SUVs and pickup trucks, which inflict more grievous injuries on pedestrians and cyclists. Fast driving on local roads is also a big factor. A recent study of the deadliest U.S. roads for pedestrians found most were in commercial areas bordering poor communities and had speed limits of at least 30 miles per hour. Community anger boiled over in Washington, D.C. last year after the city recorded at least 40 traffic fatalities, a 13-year high, and more than 4,000 injuries. Six children were hit by cars in a one-week span last month, including 9-year-old Caden Green, who may be paralyzed from the neck down. What can be done? The simplest solution is to get drivers to slow down. Most American roadways are engineered to maximize speed, and Virginia recently raised the threshold for reckless driving from 80 to 85 miles per hour. More than 20 state traffic safety bills proposed in the past 2 years went nowhere because legislators feared a political backlash from motorists. But lowering speed limits, enforcing traffic laws, and implementing traffic calming measures such as speed bumps all have been proven to reduce accidents. People like 9-year-old Peter Zekin of Washington, D.C. are paying the price for refusal to adopt these safety measures. He miraculously survived after getting hit by a speeding car in December while riding his bike. "I want people to drive safely," Zekin said, "because I don't want other people to be in pain like this." We'll read a few of the best columns, starting with "Democrats are alienating moderates." In the wake of Donald Trump, Democrats had one job. "Don't be crazy," said Matt Lewis. But they're blowing it. If Democrats wonder why they're likely to get creamed in the midterms by a party unwilling to condemn an insurrection, just consider some recent policy decisions. The short-lived walkout by the Chicago Teachers Union reminded voters that it was mostly Democrats and teachers who imposed the prolonged pandemic-related closure of schools over the past 2 years. In New York City, Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg announced last week his office would ask for jail time only for the most egregious crimes and let people convicted of robberies, assaults, and even gun possession go free. This is happening at a time when violent crime is up dramatically in major cities, including New York. It gets even crazier. The city's new mayor, the supposed centrist Democratic, Eric Adams, this week decided to back a new law allowing non-citizens to vote in New York City elections. Republicans all over the country will point to that law as evidence of what Democrats want to do nationally. Do Democrats realize how radical their policies look to middle America? What about Epstein's customers? The guilty verdict for Ghislaine Maxwell last week should bring welcome relief to those victimized by Jeffrey Epstein, said Wendy Murphy, But Maxwell's conviction for serving as the procurer of underage girls for Epstein shouldn't mark the end of the investigation into their sex trafficking ring. Maxwell is rightly being held accountable for her role in finding and grooming girls for Epstein and his wealthy, powerful friends, but none of the men who took advantage of Maxwell's services has been charged. This circle consists of many prominent businessmen, politicians, actors, and academics. One of the girls Maxwell procured, Virginia Giuffre, has sued Britain's Prince Andrew, an Epstein buddy, for allegedly having sex with her when she was a teenager. But Giuffre did not participate in the trial against Maxwell, which prosecutors kept narrowly focused on Maxwell's action and close relationship with Epstein. Thus far, Andrew has not been charged. Maxwell now served many years in prison for her crimes. Epstein died by suicide in jail after his 2019 arrest, but justice demands more. The buyers, the users, the customers, the Johns, and the rapists whom Maxwell supplied with teens must also be exposed and prosecuted. This column comes from Germany. You can't cheat your way to net zero. Every schoolchild knows that natural gas and nuclear energy are not green energy sources, said Teresa Crisman. Natural gas may be less polluting than oil, but its largest component is methane, which is 25 times more harmful to the climate than carbon dioxide. And nuclear plants excrete radioactive waste, glowing mountains of rubbish that must be stored for thousands of years. Yet the European Commission, the European Union's executive branch, has decided that the only way to hit its goal of net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050 is to reclassify natural gas and nuclear power as sustainable. It's preposterous, like announcing a weight loss program and then declaring cherry cake and sausage to be diet food. The Commission has included nuclear and natural gas on its list of climate-friendly projects that investors are encouraged to back. The list was supposed to build up renewables such as wind and solar power until they could supplant oil and coal. But if money instead goes to nuclear and natural gas projects, it will take decades before profits start to flow back to investors, making it impossible to phase out these dirty methods of energy generation. That is the exact opposite of environmental protection, and it could doom us to a nightmarish future. The last word, our feature article, is a different look at the January 6th insurrection. A day of stunning savagery. Police guarding the Capitol on January 6th expected to face a crowd of angry demonstrators, said Susan Dominus and Luke Broadwater in the New York Times Magazine. They weren't prepared for a violent assault on democracy. On the morning of January 6, Caroline Edwards, a 31-year-old United States Capitol Police officer, was stationed by some stairs on the Capitol grounds when the energy of the crowd in front of her seemed to take a different shape. It was like that moment when rain suddenly becomes hail. A loud, sour-sounding horn bleated, piercing through the noise of the crowd, whose cries coalesced into an accusatory chant. USA, USA. Edwards, who is 5'4", tried to make herself look imposing. Behind a row of bike racks alongside four other officers, she stood in a wide stance, her hands on her hips. A man in front of her whipped off his jacket as if he were getting ready for something, flipped his red MAGA hat backward, and then rioters were pushing the bike racks forward as the police officers pushed back, trying to hold their balance. A sergeant standing closer to the Capitol looked over just in time to see a bike rack heaved up and onto Edwards, whom he recognized by her tied back blonde hair. She crumpled to the ground, head hitting concrete, the first officer down in what would prove to be a bloody, bruising battle, the worst assault on the Capitol since 1814, when the British burned the building to the ground. The crowd howled and roared, rushing past the barricade as the sergeant started screaming into the radio orders to lock all Capitol doors. Edwards' blue cap had been knocked from her head. Once she got back on her feet, she stood, dazed and leaning on a railing for support, her hair loose and disheveled, as riders flung themselves past the barriers, her colleagues punching back the few they could. Officers around the building heard over the radio an anguish call distinct from any other they had encountered on the job. Help! On the other side of the Capitol, Harry Dunn, a 6'7" former college football player, thought he recognized that voice. It sounded to him like Edwards, an officer he'd trained, someone whom more officers than seemed possible considered a close personal friend, including Dunn. He started running toward the West Front. Inside, near the U.S. Capitol Visitor Center, Devin Gowdy was putting on his riot gear when he heard that same call for help, frantic and high-pitched, and then his unit was sprinting through the building, down two flights of stairs and out a door on the west front of the building. Gowdy, blinking, took in a scene that seemed to have been spliced in from some other unfamiliar world. A crowd of thousands raged before him. Standing on a small wooden stage built for the inauguration, he felt as if he'd been performing for a murderous, violent audience as people started throwing cans, paintballs, bolts, bottles fizzing with hydrogen peroxide. One rioter he saw was wielding a hatchet with the American flag wrapped around the blade. Many officers who worked riot control knew from experience to take their name tags off before heading into the fray. But Gowdy, a slender 27-year-old with nearly 3 years on the force, had left his on. "Hey, Gowdy, look at Gowdy," a rioter screamed. "Gowdy, Gowdy, you're scared," another jeered. One of Gowdy's sergeants, Akilo Gonnell, a 42-year-old veteran of the war in Iraq, who was close by, unable to move from his position lest the crowd burst through, heard the taunts and was chilled to the bone. Gowdy looked at him beseechingly, but what could he do? Gonnell saw a rider pull hard at the shield in Gowdy's hand, the two of them rocking back and forth. Gonnell thought his officer was hit hard in the head with his own shield. Gowdy only knows that a flagpole clattered to his feet just after he felt a blow. Another officer pulled him back to safety inside the building. Amid the chaos, Gonnell lost track of the other members of his unit, a tight-knit crew that usually worked the midnight shift. Soon he was one of the few officers near a lower west entrance to the building who still had a shield. Other officers had either lost theirs in battle or never had one in the first place, and was bracing himself in the doorway, barely holding on. A rioter smashed his hand with a baton. Gonnell slipped on a pile of shields and wet with toxic spray and feared that the rioters, grabbing his leg, his shield, his arm, would pull him apart before he was somehow able to right himself. Edwards had gathered herself and spent more than an hour, or was it days, time lost all sense, fighting off rioters or helping other officers on the lower west terrace of the Capitol. She was positioned near a friend from her shift, Brian Sicknick, when they were hit with chemical spray directly in their faces. Edwards' hands flew to her eyes as she bowed down in pain and stumbled. Sicknick retreated to wash out his eyes, then returned to the fight. Another officer escorted Edwards, her lungs searing from toxic spray, away from the scene to get medical treatment. Anton, a 34-year-old Navy veteran in Gonnell's unit, had been ordered, along with the rest of the officers on the West Front, to retreat into the Capitol. Inside, a friend grabbed his tactical vest, screaming, "They're in the building!" They realized that if the rioters came down the interior stairs near the lower west entrance, They would attack from behind. Grinnell and other officers who were fending off the crowd at the door. Anton, who asked to be identified only by his middle name to protect his privacy, ran up two flights, using his shield to shove clusters of riders back up the stairs. Arriving two floors up at the rotunda, amid paintings of American generals courteously accepting their enemy's surrender, he joined a melee that was savage, without rules or limits. By then, the District of Columbia Metropolitan Police had arrived in force as allies in the fight, its only audience the presidential statues encircling the room. A beaming Ronald Reagan, a fierce Andrew Jackson, Dwight Eisenhower, and a pose of resolve. Anton took none of it in. He was punching, his fists bloody, hitting men, women, equipment, trying to push the crowd back. Even as he fought, his mind was flooding with questions. Was he going to die here? And if he did, would these demonic faces be the last thing he saw? What would it take for him to actually use his gun? And what the hell happened to Hoyt? He had been separated from his friend, Lennox Hoyt, a 32-year-old U.S. Army veteran who served in the military police in Afghanistan. Only later did Anton learn, stricken with guilt, just how badly the day had gone for him. Hoyt was pulled into the crowd, yanked so hard that his gear ripped. Someone beat his hand with a pipe. Another rioter swung a piece of scaffolding at him before he was able to tear himself free. He ended up trapped with another officer in an enclosure beneath the inaugural stage, its doors embedded with electric circuitry serving as their barricade. Injured, he spent hours there surrounded by a mob that kept trying to break through those doors, unable to leave as chemical spray rained down between the planks of wood overhead. Another friend, Dominic Trikosh, was off duty but drove to the Capitol after a fellow officer texted the unit's group chat saying something serious was underway at the Capitol. Fighting, plunging into the crowd to try to help another officer who had been swarmed, he wept chemically induced tears as if his body's physical reaction matched the grief and terror he felt in a crowd he was certain wanted to kill him. His eyes felt as if they were merely receptacles for pain. Even the air seemed to be on the attack. "Traitor, traitor," the rioters chanted, as someone flung a bike rack at him and he fell down a flight of stone stairs. The stone, slick and slippery with blood and tear gas, was punishing. An officer on the west front, a large man with a beard, fell hard on the stairs and was out cold for 3 minutes. A friend threw himself over that man's body to protect his gun, his own hand breaking amid the trampling horde. Dunn, when he rushed to the west front, found that he could not make his way through the crowd to find Edwards. He tried to help hold the line by the western lawn, positioned high above the crowd, his rifle aimed at a mob throwing smoke bombs and waving Confederate and thin blue line flags. Like nearly every armed officer that day, he held his fire, out of restraint, but also fear. How many rioters would fire right back? The police were clearly outnumbered. Back inside the building, Dunn positioned himself on the floor below the rotunda, stopping rioters who were trying to get past him to an area where officers were recovering. Once Gunnell was able to retreat inside, he was relieved to see Dunn. Gunnell's left shoulder was badly injured, but he was using that arm to try to help transport Roseanne Boyland, a member of the crowd who had lost consciousness and had no pulse. Dunn joined Gunnell and others as they carried Boyland upstairs so she could be administered CPR. She would later be pronounced dead. By early evening, with the help of Metropolitan Police, the Capitol Police had all but cleared the building, and the National Guard had finally arrived. Officers downstairs in the crypt were on their knees in the hallway, racked with coughs, or standing bereft in a long line for the bathroom, which was crowded with colleagues trying to soothe their seething eyes. When Anton saw Trikosh, he looked as if he had been dipped in a vat of flour, covered in the residue of all that chemical spray. Anton was taking a break from checking that rooms throughout the Capitol were clear when he heard the word over the radio that an officer, he didn't know who, was receiving CPR. He looked down over a railing and saw, one floor below, some close friends from the midnight shift huddled over a body in uniform. He rushed to direct the EMTs to the right elevator. When he joined his friends, he saw that the person they were helping was Brian Sicknick, Edward's shiftmate. He realized that a day he thought could not possibly get even more horrific just had. In the rotunda, Dunn collapsed against the wall beside a fellow officer openly weeping. In a raw moment that would reverberate beyond that day, he called out in anguish, "Is this America?" This is an excerpt from The Capitol Police and the Scars of January 6, published by the New York Times Magazine on January 4th. There have been a number of notable deaths since our last issue. We'll read two of the obituaries. The trailblazing actor who broke Hollywood's color barrier, Sidney Poitier, 1927 to 2022. Sidney Poitier was America's first black movie star. In a string of leading roles in the 1950s and 60s, the tall, charismatic Bahamian upended a long tradition of black actors playing entertainers or servants and gave audiences something unprecedented. Black characters with poise, dignity, and authority. He was the first black nominee for a Best Actor Oscar for his portrayal of an escaped prisoner chained to a white racist in 1958's The Defiant Ones. 5 years later, he became the first to win that Oscar in his role as an itinerant handyman who helps a group of nuns build a church in Lilies of the Field. His fame hit a peak in 1967 when he starred in three major hits, To Sir with Love, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, a taboo-shattering film about an interracial couple, and In the Heat of the Night, in which he gave his most celebrated performance as a Philadelphia detective who helps a racist Mississippi sheriff, Rod Steiger, investigate a murder. An active voice in civil rights movement, Poitier faced criticism from more militant blacks for playing sainted characters unthreatening to whites, a criticism he understood but rejected. There's a place for people who are angry and defiant, and sometimes they serve a purpose, he wrote, but that's never been my role. The seventh child of Bahamian tomato farmers, Poitier grew up on Cat Island, an impoverished 45-mile-long narrow strip of land with no plumbing or electricity, said the Los Angeles Times. He quit school at age 13 and worked as a water boy for ditch diggers to help support the family. At 15, he was jailed overnight for stealing ears of corn, and his concerned father sent him to live with an older brother in Miami. Stunned by the racism he encountered, he soon left for New York City, arriving with less than $4 in his pocket. He slept on rooftops and on cold nights in pay toilet cubicles until he landed a dishwashing job and moved into a $5-a-week room in Harlem. In 1945, Poitier responded to a newspaper ad seeking actors for the American Negro Theater, said the New York Times. His audition, in which he read haltingly in a thick Bahamian accent, was a flop. But he bought a cheap radio and practiced English by copying announcers and was accepted to the theater's acting school in exchange for free janitorial work. Given a stage role, he impressed a Broadway producer and was cast in an all-black production of Lysistrata, then a roadshow of Anna Lucasta. He landed his first substantial film role in 1950's No Way Out, playing a doctor antagonized by a racist patient. A sprinkling of film and television roles followed, but Poitier still bounced between acting jobs and menial work. He hit a turning point when cast as a troubled student in the 1955 hit Blackboard Jungle, said The Guardian, and as Hollywood belatedly tackled racial themes in the following years, Poitier gradually emerged as a star. Handsome and confident, Poitier could fume with barely suppressed rage on screen, said Variety. But his disciplined restraint provoked his more militant critics, who labeled him a step-and-fetch-it in a gray flannel suit. Stung by the criticism and tiring of racial politics, he retreated to the Bahamas for a few years, said the Daily Telegraph. And when he reemerged in the early 70s, it was as a director. While none of his output earned critical praise, he helmed several hits, including the prison comedy Stir Crazy, 1980, starring Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor. In later years, his most celebrated work was on TV, playing Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall in Separate But Equal, 1991, and Nelson Mandela in Mandela and de Klerk, 1997. By then, his achievements had begun to be recognized, and he was showered with honors, including a Presidential Medal of Freedom and a Lifetime Achievement Oscar. Poitier insisted he'd simply been in the right place at the right time, selected almost by history itself. But, he wrote, I am nonetheless gratified at having been chosen. The actress and wicked wit who became TV's golden girl. Betty White, 1922 to 2021. Betty White's small screen career was one for the record books. In February 1939, a then 17-year-old White danced in front of the cameras for an experimental TV broadcast, and over the following eight decades was rarely absent from the medium. Though best known as a comedic actress, she was likely the first solo female talk show host in history and one of the few successful female producers of the 1950s. Dubbed the First Lady of Television, she worked on comedies, dramas, game shows, commercials, and televised parades. White had her most memorable roles in two classic sitcoms as the nymphomaniacal Sue Ann Nivens on The Mary Tyler Moore Show and the delightful but dim Rose Nyland on The Golden Girls, and cultivated a sunny, chipper persona that belied a wicked sense of humor. Asked at age 88 if there was anything left she would like to do, she replied, Robert Redford. Born in Oak Park, Illinois, and raised in Los Angeles, White was the only child of a radio repairman father and a homemaker mother. She showed early interest in theater, said the Washington Post, and won several acting jobs on radio and stage. Her career stalled during her brief 1945 marriage to a fighter pilot. The relationship ended when White realized she'd have to live on an Ohio chicken farm. In 1949, White joined a six-day-a-week Los Angeles TV talk show as the sidekick of Al Jarvis, said the New York Magazine. She succeeded him as host and soon won her first lead acting role in the sitcom Life with Elizabeth. White later hosted and produced her own variety show, The Betty White Show. When NBC pressured her to fire black tap dancer Arthur Duncan because of complaints from local affiliates in the Jim Crow South, she refused and increased his airtime. The show was canceled within the year. By the early 1960s, she was best known as a very busy freelance guest on game shows, said the New York Times. A regular panelist on Password, she married its host, Alan Ludden, in 1963, and their union lasted until his death in 1981. Her biggest acting break came relatively late in life when she was cast in 1973 as Sue Ann, the annoyingly upbeat, sexually conniving host of a local household hints program on The Mary Tyler Moore Show. White won two Emmys for that role and another in 1986 for The Golden Girls. White had initially read for the lustful Blanche Devereaux character, said Rolling Stone, but was instead cast as Rose, a cheerfully naive widow who confounds her roommates with surreal monologues about her Minnesota hometown. At times, she was so committed to the bit that even veteran co-stars like Rue McClanahan and Bea Arthur wound up breaking character with fits of unscripted laughter. In 1992, Golden Girls spinoff flopped, but White was never really out of the public eye, said CNN.com. A role in the 2009 movie The Proposal and a memorable Snickers commercial inspired a Facebook campaign to have her on Saturday Night Live. And in 2010, she became that show's oldest ever host. She worked well into her 90s, appearing in the 2010-15 sitcom Hot in Cleveland and in 2019's Toy Story 4 as Bitey White, a tiger-shaped chew toy. "I'm the luckiest old broad on 2 feet," she said in 2017. "I will go to my grave saying, can I come in and read for that tomorrow?" And a few others that passed noted here. Author Joan Didion, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the biologist Edward O. Wilson, the NFL coach and announcer John Madden, former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, and actor Bob Saget. And we'll close the show with a quote from Joan Didion, who says, "You have to pick the places you don't walk away from." And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten by the law firm of W.G. Alexander & Associates. Alexander attorneys provide top-rated, experienced legal counsel concentrating on estate planning, elder law, special needs, and asset protection. Call W.G. Alexander & Associates at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.